Joseph hasn't always
done. We need one more.
Yeah, we need Tom or Gina. That would be weird if we didn't have a quorum.
I don't think we've one time in a bajillion years
we did
that.
A long time. A really long time.
You're dating yourself when you say
if
a bajillion.
If we don't have a quorum.
Since we've had to cancel, you mean it's been a long time?
It's been a long
because
time.
Because of the last quorum.
Yeah, even Dennis, I was in a meeting with Dennis last
night.
Yeah,
he's here
we go. Oh, and he said he was coming. Oh yeah, two more. So Dennis is not coming, huh?
No, but he sent his report.
Okay, because he said, okay, I'll see you. I was with him last night at ACPC, and he said, I'll see you tomorrow night.
I don't know that he said what he was doing.
Yeah.
He sent us.
It's incredibly busy. Yay, Gina! Oh, yay, Tom!
We were worried we were going to have to cancel.
No, we were parking.
I know. My husband dropped me off, so that's why I got here on time.
That's you.
That's me.
Do you want me to?
You can sit there.
We'll move you. Can I give it back to you? Would that be? I don't want you to have to
Gina? Here,
she's
going to fix you up.
Okay. Oh,
thank you.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Gosh,
amazing.
I'm going to show this to you.
Yay. Thank you for everything you're doing for this.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi.
So much. I got a good
I can't
good
tell
that.
You how much we appreciate Tom.
And I got cut the room rental in half.
Oh, my God. Oh, thank you. I noticed last
night,
too. So.
My boss thought Gina quit selling me on stuff.
Yay, that's so good.
Is this a Facebook event yet?
A what? A what?
I don't know.
I think this is a youngin' term. Is this a youngin' term, Liz? You understood what she said.
A Facebook event page just designated just for this one.
I am not a youngin' either,
no.
How old? 49.
Nah, you're a youngin'. I'm 65.
If they can, I mean, because that's how I kind of can drive it in a lot of other directions really easily.
You know what? That's what Larry did for Pride. No, it's true. I had no idea. And Larry told me about that for Pride, and we had all like 40,000 people. I said, oh, well, maybe we need to take that down.
We got it up on Orgy, too, though.
This one? Uh-huh. As an event or just like posting the flyer?
As an event.
Okay.
As a non-political event.
Okay.
And
I'll find that
and we're going to keep running.
We need an event page, though.
Yeah.
We do.
I'm with you. Yeah. Event page. Won't be me sitting up.
I don't care who hosts it. It makes it easier to share.
Yeah.
Okay. So we're going to open the meeting and of the Ashland Housing and Human Service Commission on August 22nd. And before we go to the approval of the minutes, I want everybody to note that we only have timed out till 5:30 tonight. So we're going to be a little bit leisurely. Apparently, the folks that were going to do the SEEP presentation are not able to come. So rather than fill it in, we've just got a little bit more leisurely time.
No complaint here.
I know.
So, again, before we do the approval minutes, anybody have any summer stories they want to tell as we go around or before we get started?
No. I have a new grandson.
Oh.
Yay!
That's a good
Elliot! Elliot! That's a biggie. How about you, Gina?
I don't know. Life is good.
I can officially say that the Rogue Retreat is going to open a year-round shelter in November.
Yay!
Year-round shelter?
In Medford, is in Medford?
Yeah.
Oh, so awesome. At the Kelly Shelter site?
Isn't it really in the county?
It's the building that... No, it's... building is being has been purchased by Access. I don't know the address. There's a drug program that's in there that's going to be moving out across the street, and we're waiting for them to move before we can rehabilitate the space.
Do you mean across the street from Set Free?
No.
Oh.
The old public
Is it the 1001 East Main?
It is.
A long time ago.
1000.
And actually, Road Retreat was in there.
1005. We used to do all the electrical there.
Compass House. Does anybody know where?
I know Compass House.
Compass House is terminating their lease on. They're the last people in that building, and they're going to be moving across the street.
So this is on West Main.
It's on six.
Right? Oh yeah.
Yeah, kind of by the Y, down from the Y.
Is it where you
close
thought?
To the courthouse? No. We've had some rallies at that particular courthouse.
Right up now. From. Yeah, right across from the federal.
That would be a good spot.
Oh.
Good spot. Yeah.
That's exciting. And what month? You said October?
November.
Probably opening in November. We're shooting for November.
And how many people?
I think 60.
Wow. Yay.
Oh my gosh, you guys.
That's awesome.
Two functioning winter shelters.
And there's 24/7 longer than winter. Isn't yours?
Well, all
year round.
With case management.
Wow. So
I like
great.
A question, though.
What's your source of
funding? Well, there's fundraising going on, but there is city funding and access funding. And CCO.
Might that be affected potentially by I just heard about all care potentially leaving the county?
Well,
will that affect that at all?
It could, because Road Retreat's contract with both CCOs, but all care is more all in at better rates, is seemingly more supportive of work with homeless, and so it would be theoretically, people can there'd be the same number of clients, but the way the other CCO operates is just not as good.
I recently joined their system advisory council on all care, so I knew they were being pretty supportive of that.
Yeah. Anybody else?
Last November, a group of us from the Ashland Winter Shelters went to the statewide solicitation for input on shelters, on homeless shelters, and the people doing the study just published the study. It's 160 pages long. So I don't expect you to read it, but I'm going to forward some of the key recommendations, such as year-round shelter, to Linda, and she can send it out to all of you. But it's really a fascinating report, and it's broken down county by county throughout the state and has different recommendations for different parts of the state.
Great.
I'm excited to do an interview with Emerge tomorrow. Unfortunately, Emerge, their candidate training program, specifically for women. So that's exciting. And unfortunately, it's at the exact same time as the Fix the Gap rally that's happening in North Medford.
Well, Emerge first, and then Emerge from Emerge.
But that's also at 11 in North Medford. If anybody's not working, wants to go support the fact that women there are being paid over $3 an hour less, I think, than men.
So staff, y'all want to throw in?
Where is it?
North Medford. I can send you an email.
I mean, I have update stuff, but I can save it for me.
Save it for the updates.
Okay.
I just, because we've been talking about the homeless thing. Did you all see that they did a study in the metro area of the most accurate study of the homeless population in 2017? And it was Portland State did it. And it turns out there's 38,000 people homeless in the three counties up there in 1 year.
Crazy.
And it's dramatically above the one day point in time thing. And so there's a sort of the notion that, well, the point in time is kind of nice and it gives us something, is that just completely underestimates what's out there. I mean, we can maybe extrapolate it to Southern Oregon, but I think in some ways we can. Not the 38,000, but the numbers that we would see would be much larger if we had that kind of rigorous study put to the thing.
The entire West Coast has the highest in the country.
Yes.
Yeah.
California, Oregon, Washington, and Hawaii.
Just from a personal standpoint, yeah. Because I know someone that is an addict and homeless in Portland, what are the percentages? I'm assuming most homeless people have some kind of addiction?
You know, I think our point in time count shows that a lot of people self-certify as having some sort of what would qualify as a debilitating mm-hmm. life issue.
Yeah.
Whether that's mental health or addiction.
This report has those numbers.
Does it?
It
has
graphs and tables about self-identified issues, how people became homeless. There are extensive interviews with people who live on the street in Oregon.
And when you look at Seattle is dying,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. I don't know if
isn't
anyone
that powerful?
Has seen that.
Oh, I was the one who brought it to you and said, please watch it.
I watched it.
Because
that.
It'll rivet you.
And I told everybody
yeah,
to watch that.
Me too.
You've seen that, and it shows
yeah.
how people identify. And rather than to throw mm-hmm. money at the unhoused situation, how do we go to the core and nip it in the bud?
That's it.
You know, putting Band-Aids over things. We need to get to the core, right?
Mm-hmm. More services.
And this truly shows the core and the reason and the policing, and mm-hmm. it's just, it's off the hook. I was surprised.
And then Rhode Island at the end there.
Oh, and this is the solution.
Uh-huh.
And always looking for a solution instead of accepting what is mm-hmm. and let's just throw some money at it and say.
Well, let's kind of hold on to these things. You know, a little bit later. we have Dennis is not here, but he did send a paragraph of his liaison report, and part of it is on the on the jail thing. So maybe we could use that as an opening into more of this discussion.
May I say something quick to say?
You can.
Congratulations, girlfriend. Go get it. I had my interview
the
other day. I would love for us, girl.
Wouldn't that be cool?
Yes.
Yeah. All right.
Awesome.
All right.
Wow, what a wonderful opening. So now we have to actually approve the minutes.
Okay. You read your minutes. Yes, I did.
So ably done.
I moved to approve the minutes.
I know. Heidi.
One typo. My name.
Seriously?
Where? I missed that. I can read them.
The fourth paragraph.
Yeah, it is.
I
see it. I missed that. Sorry, Heidi. Yeah. I missed it.
Yeah.
Well, so did I.
One, two, three, four.
No, it's on the first page.
Oh,
yeah.
Ridge, Rodian.
Oh,
and
there's me, too. My name.
Oh,
it's
yep.
No.
It's capital.
Way to go,
Jackie. Okay, so who did the motion?
Jackie.
I did.
Jackie did. Is there a second? Heidi? All right.
That we approve the minutes as amended.
Yeah.
As amended.
Yeah, as amended.
All right. Okay. All right. All those in favor of approving the minutes as amended, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? The minutes are carried. So we're going to the public forum. Would you like to address the public forum?
No, I'm just here to listen.
What?
Just here to listen, thank you.
To listen. You want to introduce yourself? Or?
Yeah, my name is Bob Kaplan. I've just moved here about a month, maybe a month and a half ago. Community Resource Center for the last several weeks.
Yay!
I was trying to figure out how I'd like to get involved in Ashland.
Wow, outstanding.
I moved from the East Coast, my wife and I, and interested in a whole host of issues.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
Well, we're glad you're sitting in our meetings. I hope
I'm excited. I'm really excited to hear your last last week. It's been really great discussions, and it's really impressive.
I'm on the Aura board, and Heidi is one on our steering committee for the shelter, and so please keep working with us. The Community Resource Center, awesome. Thank you. Thanks, Bob.
Okay, so.
So I intend to keep on
going. Good. Good.
So, Linda, do you want to talk about the program update?
Sure, and I don't know if you guys had a chance to read the memo in your packet, and I'll just talk a little more about it. We've talked about this before, the issue that we were having with the HOA situation sort of precipitated this, so we really did know that there were some issues with our program and that it was probably just time to look at it and update it. And mostly it's about changing the formula, which is how we calculate the resale price. And I can give a little background for you since you may not know. The City of Ashland has an affordable housing program. The program is essentially where the city de-restricts certain units in certain circumstances. We have carrots and sticks, and the sticks are primarily planning in nature. So we have an annexation ordinance, a zone change ordinance, a condominium conversion ordinance, and then we do have a bonus density ordinance, which is more of a carrot than a stick. But those things all require developers to provide affordable housing units in certain circumstances. And then the city deed restricts those units to rent or sell to targeted incomes. And the city sets the maximum resale price of those units to make sure that they transfer and are affordable to that same target population. The city also has some carrots, which we would consider our system development charge deferral. So we'll defer system development charges for housing targeting to certain income levels. And then we also have a few different grant funds that are also overseen by this group. So those things generally happen in combination with one another. But with condominium conversions, we actually passed that ordinance in 2007 because we saw so many rental units turning into condominium developments, and we were seeing that we were losing a housing source that we were really needing in our housing stock. And as a consequence, this particular unit came into the program, actually two units in a very small complex. And through the evolution of little mini changes to the resolution that established the affordable housing program, we kept tweaking it to get to how do we maintain affordability for people who are purchasing units that have HOA dues. And so part of that was that we would calculate the cost of the HOA dues in the resale formula so that it would never be unaffordable. But unfortunately, what that caused was that some HOA dues, I mean most of them, all of them, just go up. They never go down. And some, such as the case in this particular complex, went up precipitously to the point where it started to devalue the unit because the price is predicated on what somebody in that same income bracket can afford. And so we looked at a variety of different ways to resolve this issue, and one of them, of course, was, we could take it out of the program or we can stop doing HOAs, which we really can't for a variety of reasons. So what we ended up doing was we ended up increasing the threshold, the income threshold for the buyer so they could absorb the additional cost. So it had to sell to someone in the 80% of area median income bracket, and we increased that to 120% of the area median income. And then we changed the formula by which we calculate the maximum sale price, which doesn't necessarily solve the HOA problem, but we essentially said, okay, we're not going to do this pretty complex formula that we have developed over time. And the complex formula essentially is we have an interest rate that we look at, which is the Oregon Bond Rate Advantage interest rate, and we look at it in May of each year. And then we take the new income guidelines from the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and we use the person household that aligns with the number of bedrooms, which is in and of itself a little, there's a key to it, which is like a four-person household could theoretically live in a two-bedroom unit, so we'll take the average of these two, three, and four, and anyway, so then we come up with that number. And then we have the HOA dues, and we assume a 10% down payment and a bunch of other things. So it's this big, long formula spreadsheet, and it has all these moving parts. And so when people call to find out what the resale price is, I have to do this calculation, which I actually just do every year for all the different units. And then I tell people what it is, and then they say, well, why did it go up or why did it go down? And then I have to say, well, the interest rates went up, but incomes went down, or blah, 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 or some weird combination of things. And they're like, well, what do you think is going to happen next year? And then I'll have to say, I have absolutely no idea.
Let me grab my crystal ball.
I know, right? Like, there's no way to predict this. So what we decided to do with this particular unit, we did some research on best practices and what other organizations that offer affordable housing programs do, and we came up with a straight interest rate calculation that compounds over time. And
So the interest rate calculation is then what the resale is based on that particular interest rate, and the principle is to, because I read this two or three times, but I still don't understand.
Was it still confusing?
It.
Are you kidding me? Right? Oh my gosh, we're doing it. So it's essentially, okay, whatever you paid for the unit when it transferred.
Correct.
And then we multiply it by 1.5% per month from the time that you own it to the time that you sell it.
1.5% per month?
This is the change.
That's the change. And so it will be predictable. So it's like, okay, the longer you have the unit, the more it will be worth, right? So it kind of encourages the staying longer. But then you can figure it out yourself, right? You know what you paid for it. You know what month you bought it. And you know, like, if you're going to, like, right. I want to sell in November.
Let me go. I was going to try to get to what is the principle that we're doing with it. Because I know when, like, Rogue Valley Community Development Corporation owned these houses, and we had them all in trust, and then the people owned them, and then there was a formula that allowed them to sell them. But I thought the principle was something like you kept it affordable while at the same time allowing
some appreciation. Right.
And so what you don't allow, and what I'm hoping this doesn't allow full appreciation. So, I mean, because people in Ashland, sometimes we think we're making a lot of money per year over all that, but that isn't what's happening here.
So we looked at what the market has done over the past few years and the increase in values, and I think it was like 2 or 2.5%, and then we looked at like doing a 0.5 or a 1%, and we sort of split the difference and did, well, let's do this sort of happy medium. So it's not... So this is the tricky part, is as it appreciates, can it absorb the cost of that HOA as well, right? And that's the part that we can't regulate HOAs. We can't do it. And so there's no way we can control those costs.
Right.
And so we're just trying to make it reasonable. Like, you will achieve some equity, whereas in our old program, there was no guarantee, because if the price went down because your HOA went up, we would never require you to sell it for less than what you paid. You can get your money back out, but we couldn't let you sell it for more, right? So if I paid, $165 for my unit, and 10 years from now, like what happened in 2007, and incomes went down and lending got tight, then it was, sorry, you can sell it for $165.
And the purpose for us looking at this a couple of times, are we going to make a recommendation and the council is going to make a decision
on
it?
Yes, so this is just the preliminary introduction to sort of let you know the pieces that we're looking at and that we're thinking about. This has a lot of implications for our land use code, because our land use code, because of all the planning pieces, are riddled with aspects of this. One of which is this piece, this 60% of area median income. So part of our annexation and zone change ordinance is that you can target ownership housing to people earning 60% of area median income. And we only have 2 units in our program. Well, that's not true. We have 1, 2, 3, 4. We have 4 units in our program that are targeted that way. 2 of them, one of them has transferred. One of the 2 is transferred in 1 complex. And it was really, really difficult, because before 2007, anybody could get a loan for whatever. Like, it wasn't a big deal. After 2007, it became very difficult for people who had
very low incomes to get a loan, unless they came in with a huge down payment or, you know, I mean, had some other asset that they could bring to bear. So it took that, those poor people, it took them, I don't know, a couple of years to get their unit sold, just because it was so difficult to find someone who could both income qualify and afford to buy the unit. The other thing about that is it kind of defeats us in the sense that developers can provide the least amount of units if they target it to the lowest income, but they don't transfer easily. They don't sell initially easily. And the one agency that could finance them, which was Habitat for Humanity, has actually changed their lending criteria because they can't loan to people that who have incomes that low anymore either. So we kind of lost our partner in that. And one of the pieces of the ordinance is that someone can partner with a nonprofit agency to develop those affordable housing units rather than having to develop them themselves. And the only person to partner in that sense was Habitat. So we are going to be proposing that we remove that 60% for ownership. We would still keep it for rental, and it doesn't preclude people who are in that income bracket from purchasing if they're able to. It just has put, you know, we got complaints from Habitat about it, that it's just an unreasonable level for us to expect a developer to meet. We get complaints about it from developers as well, although they like that having that option, because if it's targeted to the lowest income, so it could be it's the smallest percentage you can provide. And a lot of times for us, you know, the people that we deal with the most are the actual homeowners in the unit who are, due to whatever circumstance in their life, are transferring these units over. And so we want to make it not difficult for them to be able to do what they need to do when they need to do it. Lots of times people are transferring their units, you know, not because they're moving up the ladder, but because they have taken a job in another place or, you know, have to go take care of family or something, a life circumstance that just, you know, they need to move.
So Umpqua NeighborWorks has some of these things. How does ours compare with that? Have we looked at what they do?
I'm pretty familiar with NeighborWorks Umpqua. They were interested in partnering actually on a home ownership development at that 60% level, and they were trying to figure out how they could make that work. The last I heard was they were going to go after some grant funds at the state. I would think that it is probably easier for them to do this in the Roseburg, Douglas County community than it is to do it here,
right.
At that income level. And I don't think they have a lot of ownership housing in their stock. I mean, aside from the ownership housing they have with us.
Well, they inherited some, right?
They bought it.
But where is Umpqua again, did you say?
They're in Douglas County.
Douglas, okay.
Yeah, they actually...
But they can come here, though. They're not limited.
No, they can. Right. Absolutely, yes. Yes, we've talked a lot about that.
But they haven't, and we
it's... Yeah, it's a challenge, I think. And that's the other thing, is the 60% is... It's a challenge for developers, too. How do we make this pencil, and then can we find homeowners to put in it who aren't going to be income overburdened by the housing costs?
I have a number of questions.
Okay.
One is about HOAs. Is there a way to restrict the percentage that they increase each year?
No. Mm-hmm.
It seems like there should be a penalty to someone who develops this land, and then the price goes sky high and it can't be sold as affordable.
HOAs are really strange. They are considered a business, and so they have to register as a business with the state of Oregon, the Secretary of State, and they have to provide accounting each year, and they are supposed to have an improvement plan that sets out what needs to be dealt with and when, a schedule for repairs, and then they are supposed to link the amount of money that they require in HOA fees back to that that improvement plan, and they're not allowed to charge people costs that aren't related to anything. It has to be related to something. However, what I have found is that because they are governed by an HOA board, which is generally the residents who live there, that it really depends on how the residents can function in that setting. And so, for example, what I was told about the HOA at this particular unit, and this was not the, this isn't the only HOA I've heard these things from, and so I'm not like singling them out. And it is not just these people who are here now, because the woman who owned this unit before used to call me all the time and complain about what was going on with the HOA. So essentially, what I had heard was that they just stopped doing.
Having meetings, right?
No, they were having meetings, but it was like three people were involved, and they stopped doing the accounting for it. They fired the manager, because they had their HOA sort of property managers you can hire. I guess they thought, well, we don't want to pay you to do that anymore. We'll just do it ourselves. And then when it came to file the tax stuff, like, nobody had any of the right stuff, and then they had to go and get all these bank statements and get it all together and send it all up. I did a HOA thing a long time ago with this HOA sort of property management company, and part of it was doing a mailing list to invite people to this HOA training for fair housing. And so I went through the whole list that was provided on the State of Oregon Business Registry website for Ashland, and half of them were not even in business anymore. I mean, they still had HOAs, it's just they weren't functioning and they didn't renew their business stuff.
Can the city restrict, say, on all our affordable housing contracts or whatever, we will not allow HOAs? Can we do that?
No, we can't.
Why
we
not?
Tried already, and apparently it's illegal. So we did that to the McCall subdivision, and it was
a protracted question report. Is, if they had to report the increases each year to the building department, or who enforces the rules?
The State of Oregon, which is probably why it doesn't get enforced.
So if the amount that they were allowed to charge were tied to the CPI or the AMI, or the CPI is probably a little better, maybe?
It's not at all related to that. It is related to repairs to the buildings themselves.
And pools.
And
they had a pool.
They have a pool, and they also have, so their issue is they have a pool, they have landscaping, and then they are like in a weird gully, I guess, and they have a sewage pump that pumps the sewage up to a line that then can go out, and their pump broke, and they had to get a new pump. Like I said, this is not the only HOA I've heard this from. The other HOA that we have three units in, which nobody ever complained about this, actually, strangely, but they had a water line break in their driveway, and because it was on their property and in the common area, they had to dig it up, and it ended up, that whole repair and doing all of that ended up raising their HOA fees quite a bit. And so I think the issue is you can't tie it to something, because it has to be tied to the actual things that happen there, and because they have no control over when maintenance things happen, like emergent issues, that they have to be able to charge additional money to take care of those things.
So when they're going to sell their apartment or their house, they're allowed to say, I had these increases in maintenance. It's not HOAs particularly, or it could be a combination of...
I think people just need to know that, like, this is in an HOA. This is what the fees are right now. This is how much they've gone up over time. I mean, and people should ask about HOAs. I mean, they just shouldn't. I don't think enough people understand how they work or know about them. And so, I mean, the woman who's buying the unit. So the unit is selling. Long story short, they rented it to this woman. I reached out. We had a conversation. She was income qualified, that we didn't actually think she would be, but she was. And she wanted to buy the unit. She loved it. She's getting along great with the other people. She was a little concerned about the age of how high they were. She has a friend who lives in another complex, and it's beautiful, and the landscaping is really, really well maintained, and he pays like half of what she pays.
But do they have a pool?
But here's
and
the
a
thing.
Pump.
She gets to go in knowing that this HOA issue has been a thing there, and that theirs are higher than other places. And they're, you know, they don't have nowhere to go but up. I mean, that's the horrible reality of it. And she still wanted to buy it. So it is under contract right now.
Oh, good.
Hopefully it will be closing, I don't know, in like another month.
Good.
But she's really excited to be there. They're happy to be out.
So I'm wondering if we're ready for a decision now.
Well, there isn't really any I don't need anything from you. It's just an update. Just to let you know that these are some the changes that we're moving forward with and that we'll come back with a resolution that you guys will get to read and then make a recommendation on.
So
it's going to churn again in the washing machine.
So the resolution will be... So we were looking at kind of the old thing of what was there.
Yeah, and, that was the old res. That's how it is right now. That's
so,
the program.
And so we'll look at the new one, and nothing's going to the council until we make a recommendation.
No. Okay. All right. But it's just to let you know that this is coming, and these are the changes that we are proposing. And then this was the best information I found that talks about resale formulas and sort of how to come out with it, which I think I gave you.
Yeah.
Did I answer all?
So
how
we'll
do you guys feel comfortable about a lot of weird information?
So just a question I had while you were talking, one that Jeannie was just asking, when do you think it'll come back to HHS in the resolution form? Mm-hmm.
So pretty quickly, we need to get it through the council, hopefully by the end of the year.
End of the year?
Yeah. Okay. So, yeah, we're going to.
And then a question I had was, do you know how many units in Ashland we have that are in this affordable unit program? I mean, how many are there? It seems like there's not that many.
Oh, no, there's a lot.
How many would you say?
Well, so in the affordable housing program, there's like 117 or 97. There's a bunch. There's like 100. But that's everything. Everything in the affordable housing program is anything that has ever received any sort of subsidy.
So it includes rentals as well as, well, that's
yes,
what I'm
so
wondering.
Not ownership units.
Okay.
Right.
So I'm curious on the ownership.
Ownership units.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I don't think I have it broken down by ownership units.
But would you say 50? I mean, in terms of like 50 and then maybe you have a...
Probably 50.
100 that would be the rentals. But
I think
50.
We have like 50.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was just curious.
Because
it sounds like the 60% of the AMI is you got to rent. In Ashland, you got to rent.
No, I mean, that's where we're at. And there are other, it's certain people can do it.
In the history of Ashland, that always hasn't been the case.
Okay, but I'm just saying right now, that's how it appears. If you're at that point.
And it really is about lending more than anything else.
No, I heard that, yeah. Okay.
Something else that we have no real control over. Okay.
and then there was the fixed rate versus... index-based.
Right.
So, if you have a recommendation, will that be a part of the package?
Yes, And I think we're really leaning toward the fixed rate. I mean, ours essentially is index-based now because we index it to the income guidelines, but those go up and down.
And it's easier to figure out.
It's really easy. I mean, someone could make a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
And they could know and have some assurity, and then they don't have to wait for me to do some weird... I have this poor woman who just did not understand a word of what I was saying, just going like, "What are you? Where are you coming up with these numbers? Why that? Why this? Well, shouldn't you choose something else?" And I'm like, "Well, it isn't up to me. It wasn't chosen by me." But there's a lot of options out there. We didn't have to index it to the income guidelines. We didn't, we use HUD's income guidelines because we have other programs that, we use those guidelines for. And then, like, the interest rate, we didn't have to pick the world's lowest interest rate, which was the other thing that is an issue for resale right now, is that when our program started, we picked an interest rate that is a special interest rate for low-income first-time home buyers. And not everybody can get that loan, And so their interest rate may have nothing to do with this, advantageous interest rate. And interest rates were historically low. And so they had nowhere to go, really, but up, although they're coming down now. So that was kind of penalizing buyers as well.
I have a dumb question. Are there regular home buyers in these complexes that aren't getting a subsidy?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And
so, yes and no. it's the condominium conversions that are more, so like we have three in one, you know, 10-unit complex and two in an 8-unit complex. So those people have...
So there are people who are, whose values are going way up.
Yes.
And there are people whose values you're suppressing.
Right.
Because you have to. I just...
Mm-hmm. But then we do have other complexes that where everyone has the same deal.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, like the Rice Park one, and then the Park Street, and Siskiyou and Faith. Those are all the same. Everybody there qualified the same and got the same sort of program. And so all the units are artificially suppressed.
Okay.
We're going to move from the very complicated to the moderately complicated. And look at the social service grant application recommendations from our work group here.
So this is just, you know, what we talked about last time, but I don't know if it was if I left anything out.
It looks like you wrote this very before the last meeting. Is that correct?
No. So this is from what we talked about at the last meeting.
Yeah.
I thought it was good.
Do we need a motion to approve that?
Nope, we don't. I will just work with Jan and see if we can get a different product moving forward.
And when will our product go forward?
Not for a long time.
Right, so we got some
time. We have
So it'll be a year from January.
I know.
Yes. A year from January.
Yeah, which is great. Because that gives us time.
I thought it was there were two yellow pages.
There are two yellow pages together.
Yeah. So now we're going to look at the House Bill 2916.
And really, all after we talked, all I did was some research that talks that from the you know, legislative sessions about what was different.
I kept picturing Eugene and what they do up there with their campsites and then the service center, and it just sounds like they're making it easier for communities to do the kinds of things that they've done up there.
So, but so I was talking to somebody about this. I don't, can't remember, but so now I'm all confused. But the so this allows any it allows sites inside the UBG. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't have to be in the city. Okay. So that's, that, I thought, well, this is really flexible. I like this, right? And so we're not limited under this legislation to two.
Right.
Two units, or what do you?
Which is like Eugene, right? Because Eugene has more than one.
Yeah.
And Portland, I guess, too.
Okay.
Are people who are camping still ticketed for illegal campsites?
Like.
Well, if they're
currently
illegal,
they are.
They will be.
Yeah. If they're on the street, you mean, or
in the watershed or anywhere?
Here in Ashland?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Sure.
So.
But this is a whole different discussion, though. I will say I'm excited about this because I can remember I'd come back from Eugene, I'd seen the kinds of things they were doing, and when I was talking with the city about. Hey, we could do this. You know, there's land near the railroad tracks and over there by Bi-Mart and different places where, you know, it would be near the bus line and we could, you know, and it was like tense, you know. I mean, I was not the greatest reaction that we don't, that chain link and tent, I mean, you know, so I thought, oh. But this is like, here's Pam Marsh going, hey, it's a crisis.
Yeah.
Let's open it up and be...
Well, I think it's more than Pam. Of course, the whole legislature has said this is a good option we want to encourage.
It's a whole change in
and
thinking,
and
so, is what I
and
think.
It goes along with a whole change of thinking on housing in this last session. And the question is, does it sort of stop at Ashland's city boundaries or something?
I think it does, because once you get into, like, counties, I think it's just, you know, it's a different...
Well, no, I wasn't saying that. I mean, does the... interest in doing this not really arrive in. I mean, we have the opportunity. The question is, Is there any interest in doing this anywhere? And it seems like we've put a lot of wonderful work into winter shelters. We've been talking about that, but the question about camping has not arrived. Would that?
No, I think we're right on the threshold. I think people have been having this conversation. It's really interesting because I was having this conversation with Pam Marsh last year, and one of the things that we were talking about is how you can't do tent cities, and you can't do yurts, and you can't do these things because of the state law. Mm-hmm. It's the state law doesn't allow these things.
But it's interesting
that Pam, but it was actually precipitated by the League of Oregon Cities. They were the ones who put it forward.
Good. What should be our response?
That's my question is like we can say okay, and that sort of ends the thing, and nothing would happen ever, right? I mean, so the question is, I don't know that we have to do, but I just wondered what's going to be the next step? Is the city going to encourage? I don't know. I mean, it's really landowners is the whole story here, folks. You have to have.
Well, the city is the landowner. Municipalities are allowed to allow people to set up a camp.
So let's use an example.
Okay.
So it probably won't work, but so the Washington Street property, the Aura, mm-hmm. has that land. Mm-hmm. So in 3 years, when the winter shelter mm-hmm. permit is done, and maybe it gets annexed to the city, so Irvine decides he wants to build on that.
Sure.
So then maybe there isn't a winter shelter anymore because the church will be torn down. Could an organization look at building something like Eugene has that is chain link fencing, has maybe wooden platforms, has tents on top of those wooden platforms with a major hut that's a communal, you know, living, meeting area, community, and then separate bathroom, and then separate cooking area.
That's my understanding.
See, that's the thing. That's what I'm saying.
Right.
Because
it's got land. That's
and
the
it
whole
also,
thing.
Yeah. So exactly. So you have to have the land, and the land has to be okay with the city and this law. So where Washington Street property is.
Well, you're still in the urban growth boundary. It's not
so
outside.
It's outside
the city limits,
you're
but
still
it's
regulated.
So it would work. So where
but
I could see it becoming really helpful is if we get in a bind and we don't have a new shelter built that we would want.
But you could do a retreat transitional. Yeah. Right. You could do something like Hope Village.
Yeah.
And in fact, we could have two Hope Villages.
Uh huh.
Whereas before we could only have one.
I know. I saw that as an example. I thought that was so cool.
Right.
You know. Yeah. Expand it.
So I think it just was removing some barriers that were allowing organizations that already had this idea and wanted to move forward in different areas from doing that.
Right. And I was just impressed by the encouragement of the legislature in doing
too.
This. I mean, it seemed like they're, we want you
I'm
to
very
go
surprised.
Forth and produce these things.
I think we need to do a public information campaign. I think it's really important for people to know that this option exists. And that additional dwelling units exist without permits. I think it's really important in this crisis time
because
to let people know the option.
I had a real estate agent ask me about the 2001 zoning stuff, and I was like, yeah, that doesn't really affect Ashland because we're not big enough, for one thing. We're only 20,000 in population, and so we wouldn't be required to do like a triplex. We could do a duplex in a single family zone, except that you can do that now because you can put an ARU on your property and it can be attached or detached or whatever. Like, so we've already allowed that. Like, it isn't changing things for us or making more housing units necessarily for us.
And do you know, I think, Heidi, you answered your own question, and I completely agree. What's the next step? What do we do?
Do you think people need
to know. I think that would be, I don't know, am I right or wrong? I think that would be the next step. Because, like you said, we could say yes to it and nothing happens.
But is that part of our handouts for the event?
That resource that we want to be able, because we want people to walk away with information. So So I would think
a little bit later on our agenda, we're going to talk about our forum that we're doing, and it looks pretty terrific. And it's an example of a public education really being hopefully able to move things forward. Seems to be what you're suggesting is that there's another opportunity around this bill plus other homeless. I mean, we're kind of moving in the state to another level of discussion about homeless issues. And so maybe we ought to have another working group that could figure out the time and the place and the people together that would be that public education. Is that what you were thinking of?
I don't know what I was thinking. I was asking this commission what their opinion is about what we should do.
Are we allowed to draft and recommend a press release to the council or something?
Well, that's tricky.
Does
how
the city
do
ever do press releases, like, as the city?
Yes, yes, okay. We do. Coming from the city, though.
Cut, yeah.
The city administrator.
Yeah.
I mean, clearly, like, we probably couldn't just directly ourselves,
right.
But we could recommend something, couldn't we?
If you wanted to, we could, I mean, you could put
recommend
something together, and I could send it up the chain and
yeah.
see if it gets any traction. Doesn't always,
I mean, if
though.
I getting word out.
Well, and it'd be... Yeah, it would be nice. I think there's some clarifications.
See, I still need to digest this. I need to talk to some people about it. I need to get some clarification. I need to use examples and see what's really possible. So I don't feel comfortable right at the moment to just go out. I don't know, but that's just me.
Well, it seems like there's some interest. I mean, this is a good conversation that's beginning, and that maybe we should explore it more as an item of its own.
Doesn't seem like it's. We've got the forum on renters coming up, so we're not gonna. We don't want to interrupt that,
right.
and we do have time on this. So, is it something that we want to kick ahead to September, October?
Yeah, I would. I agree we need to know more, and maybe that's kind of my personality. I'm more like, yeah, let's go. But I think that it's good to know more about it. I don't want to give it too much time until it's like on the back burner there. Oh, yeah, six
right.
months ago we talked about
right.
it. So to put it on September, but then could we still go ahead and give that little suggested press release? Can we still? I mean, I would like people to know that we're very interested in this, because in October we're going to have our event. I think this would be great to be on the resource sheet.
Or if there's a work group to draft something to look more into it and formulate what that would look like.
I'm wondering what we recommend. If on state level it's authorized now. Do we want a campground? Do we want a tiny house project? What do we want? What's appropriate for this end of the valley?
Mm-hmm.
And that seems a reasonable thing for the Housing Human Service Committee to come up with. It seems to me that people on the street aren't going to be able to do anything. I think an agency will be able to raise funds and get the momentum to do something. But I think our job is to say that we need to take advantage of this new development. But I'm not sure how, whether it's platforms that you can camp on or a tiny house village. I know Karen Logan is still interested in doing that, but doesn't have the wherewithal. Aura could do it.
The land is so important with, to have that. So, I mean, I don't know, did Karen ever come up with land?
Kind of. Well,
she's got the house.
Land, and but there's a large area around the house that she has fantasies about So
it's on that same. Oh, okay, I didn't realize that she was looking at that. Okay,
but that's in the county, and it's not in the urban growth boundary. I don't believe. I think it's far enough out. I almost see. I mean, I guess and this would be the part that would be beneficial to me is to sort of clarify what our end game is. What do we want the result to be? If I feel like there's a planning aspect to it, which is not me.
Because it could be city-owned land. See, if there was city-owned land, and then you look at HHS on how do you develop that city-owned land, that would make sense to me. It's the land that that's a obstacle. Okay.
I agree. We need to put it together so it'll be viable and attractive to people so they'll buy into it.
So, you know, when we had the very first homeless task force, when we first did that, we opened the door to people's ideas. And we had a formal process in which they sent us their ideas, and then we sat down and kind of sorted through. And some of them actually manifested. So I'm wondering whether in all of this, whether there's an opportunity to sort of open the creative doors out there, but not just metaphorically, but sort of with a little bit of a process behind it. Please send us this kind of, there was almost like a form that we asked people to fill out, I think. And we had a date in which they turned them back in, and we ended up with like 20 of them. And then some of them were kind of like out the door, and some of them were ones that we moved on. And I wondered whether it's kind of like a public education piece, but it's an invitation for creativity to come back in. The question is, you still have to organize it, and it has to be in a certain time schedule.
Part of the problem with the winter shelters is winter shelters have limited amount of time that they can be open. If it's in the city doesn't have the same constraints as the county. And so 90 days is really a short amount of time. It doesn't cover our winter season. You can apply to have the time extended. And you may or may not be authorized to do that. So, you know, we're planning this shelter, but it's probably, unless we get an extension, going to be shorter than what we've done in the past.
Are you talking about this coming year for the Asheville Winter Shelter? I haven't heard that. So, I mean, I'm hearing end of November to March. So I'm not hearing them say April, but that was generally the plan before, and it ended up staying open longer. So I'll look into that. I haven't heard that.
Well, okay, we got one volunteer to look into something. Is this something? Would somebody be willing to spend the next month thinking about some things to bring into the next meeting? I hate to just move something onto the next meeting, and we're just having the same conversation. Again, we can do that, or can we have some options brought into the next meeting?
The problem that I have right now is just I am buried right now with getting the winter shelter organized, answering questions, meeting with people in the community. I mean, I have two meetings within 4 days with people, what's going on, and explaining, and da da da. So, and I'm having about 3 to 4 meetings a week on the winter shelter. And we just are just hiring the winter shelter program director. So it's a really crazy time, and I don't want to I'm worried about getting ahead of something. There's much education I think we need to get on this before we just jump on something. So
there is an advantage to just putting out the notion that we want ideas to come in, because then somebody else is doing the work and we get to screen it. So that's
I'm concerned that we're making it more complicated. And before we move on, why can't the commission recommend to the city that because of these changes in the regulations, we need to identify property where we can do this, this, and this, and it's a priority of the city. And we don't have to identify the people to build it or run it. We identify the need.
That's awesome.
And it's time to jump on this because we have all these people that need somewhere to go, and this is an option.
I think that's a great idea.
Okay, I saw a lot of heads nodding on that, so but let me just see if I have it straight. So we're using our power of recommendation in a formal way to the council to say...
Tell us what land is.
I mean, we need somebody to, like, just put those words into that fit 2916.
That the city already owns.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Okay. So I would say that's a great idea, so we'll...
But it's limited. I mean, we're trying to solve the whole problem instead of just pushing for...
Well, it's a good
start.
One great thing would be to present it to the council along with Pam Marsh.
Pam Marsh, she
signed this. Have her present to the council.
That's very powerful. Very important.
This is a change that comes from the state and it's an emergency decree.
Even better idea if she's willing to do it. But let me say, so there's a couple of options within that framework. So I'm just remembering when we've made other recommendations to the council, and where did it go? there isn't a super easy process for this. And so we don't have our liaison person who would be one of the places that we would just could make it real easy to do that.
We could recommend, along with the recommendation, we can include a date that we'd like the information back by.
Well, good news on the information.
It doesn't have to be super fast.
It can happen pretty fast, I think, because Dennis and I both served on the shelter committee where we worked with Adam Hanks, and he researched every piece of property the city owns in this town. It's already written up. It's in a spreadsheet. Yeah. And so all that needs to happen now is if anything was bought between last year and this year, and then it has to be identified where it's located and to
what
meet
its zoning is.
The zoning that meets the... Yes, and that's the part that if you could help or planning could help identify those. But we already have the list.
So it almost reminds me of the time that we put together the information for the Housing Trust Fund and then went to the study session and had a range of options that we presented to the council.
Right. I was going to say a study session is a better than thinking at a council meeting. Mm-hmm. But so part
tell them they don't have to do the rules review. They can do something more interesting.
Yeah. So does somebody want to make a motion? Because I think we're close to this, but let's see if we can...
In September, when this comes back on the agenda, we can have a discussion about what those specific requirements will be. Because that's what we need, right? We need to identify what those are.
Which requirements?
Well, that the piece of land needs to meet. Like, we need a piece of land that we can do these specific things on.
But couldn't you do that better for us?
I don't know.
Well, you've got the information on the bill.
Mm-hmm. But is there something, Tom, when you brought that up, that you were thinking specifically of certain criteria?
I'm not sure what we would want. Camping, tiny houses.
I mean, it could be a range.
Anything the bill talks about.
UGB,
you know,
right? That's the main thing.
Yeah, exactly. So it has to be in the urban growth boundary, right? Mm-hmm. And is there it? And then it would the whole range of options that's discussed in the bill.
Okay.
You know, tangentially, Rogue Retreat was in conversations with a family that owns property on Tolman Creek Road next to Albertson's. Mm-hmm. and they got cold feet, and I think it was because they were worried about the status of this acreage remaining farmland and water rights and irrigation and whatever. And they were talking to a metric agency about doing a tiny house project on a couple of acres.
That'd be huge.
But I think the family is still would be in. They were very interested in doing this for a portion of their land, but they wanted the other portion to remain a place where they could graze animals and do this and whatever. And it got too complicated in there. She lives in Portland now, but for them to figure out all the ins and outs from the city's standpoint.
It actually is in the county.
And it's
That's in the county, that land?
Yeah.
That's in the county.
Oh.
And it is all zoned as exclusive farm use,
EFU.
All of it. And so to take 2 acres of it and split it off and make it into another use was a whole planning, zoning
nightmare
change at the county level.
Government have the ability to cut through some of that red tape?
No. Not local versus county. You know what I mean? That it's if it's county, it's
well,
county.
The
county can.
Okay.
So couldn't we just give a direction? Just, I mean, could we?
Well, let's see. I like motions.
Oh, okay.
Only in that they're clear. We could have a direction that's clear, but I think we want to be specific about what we want to do for it. So the simplest one. Let's say is we want it to come back in September, right? I mean, does everybody agree with that?
That's good. Mm-hmm.
Okay, right. Second one is that we want to make a recommendation to council that includes a study session.
Well, I'd wait. Well, I'd go with the list first.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
My thought is that we don't want to we don't want to piecemeal it out. Okay, now we want a list. And then once we get the list, now we want to stay. I think we want, what we're saying is that our priority is that we have an opportunity to use 2916 as a strong opportunity for positive motion on homelessness. And that includes,
I like it.
It includes a study session, a list of those things, mm-hmm. and then that would be the third one.
So it's a list of city-owned land in the urban growth boundary.
And or other ideas that anybody has. But I mean,
well, maybe we want the whole list, the city-owned list, the land that the city owns, and then a subcategory showing those the land that's in the urban growth boundary that would fit with 2916. Mm-hmm. So, but both lists.
So if we and that we want in their look ahead, we want to have the notion of utilizing that land as a homeless opportunity to be available for all of us to come in and discuss.
I like it.
Did that?
Second.
We don't need to second. We're just going to go with that as a written piece. And then one of the pieces that we should, it's not written in there, but we should send it to Dennis as one of the things. Because if he was here, he might be an advocate for us within that process.
Do you think it would be helpful to either have a meeting with Pam while she's in town this summer, and or even invite her to our next meeting? To ground us in this measure and put some, and maybe add some weight to it.
I wouldn't say not to. I don't know. Here's the point: do you invite her to the September meeting, Well, when we're still just hearing that, or a later one.
I think before that, maybe if a couple members of the commission meet with Pam.
Correct.
Congratulate her on this and say, we want to take this and go forward. What do you think?
Right. I think that's a great idea. If we stop here, we can... I think we've got notes on all of this, and that's a great idea. And the next step would be, who wants to be the two people to meet with her?
I'll be glad to do it. Oh, I just put her on a tour of Hope Village, and she was just overwhelmed.
Great. That's perfect, you guys. That is real good. And then you guys have some ability to figure out when, if she comes to the council or wherever, or comes to us, what is the time and bring it. Perfect.
Yeah.
Who was the other person?
Hi.
Okay.
Awesome.
Okay.
Accomplishing lots in short amount of time.
Yeah, I know.
Well,
that's great.
That's amazing.
Okay, so now the rent burden form.
Yes, and I typed up a memo that we've mailed out to the subcommittee, but there's a copy of the memo here on the table that was handed out because we met after the packet went out. And so, I don't know, Gina or Rich, would you like to talk about this?
Well, Gina, do you want to just kind of share what we've got down here?
Okay, Sarah, you want to ask somebody?
I missed the most recent meeting, so.
No, actually, from our first notes, we just kind of fixed, or shall I say, the flow of it is better, and we have people confirmed. We have four panel members. Pam, do you want to tell us a little bit about Pam Pham Community Alliance?
Yes, this is a community alliance of tenants. I volunteer with them, so that's how I've gotten to know her. And I've been able to attend renter's rights trainings that she's facilitated down here. And I think she's a great speaker, super personable.
Very knowledgeable on affordable housing also.
Just
got the whole
package. Spends a lot of time at the legislators, part of her role with Community Alliance Tenants, so she's knowledgeable about the laws and also about, you know, keeps really good tabs, I think, on what tenants are dealing with throughout the state.
And thank you, Sarah. Sarah contacted her and got her on board. Then we have this Joe. Linda, do you want to talk about Joe, Nonprofit Legal Services?
Well, I think we can just run through them. I don't know. We have to get a bio.
And then Claude LeBanc is the president of Southern Oregon Rental Owners.
LeBeau.
President of the Southern Oregon Rental Owners Association. He's bringing his attorney, Michael Stout. I spoke to him the other day. I believe he has a lot to bring, and he let me know that he works with the landlords and with the renters. So that's really good. And he works with Claude, who has a property management company, and anything that's legal that Claude would feel uncomfortable talking about, Michael's more than happy to share that. I also sent you an email,
yes,
Linda, about he's having Michael Stout is going to be at the Ashland Library.
Yeah, we should send it out to everyone, or I can forward it out to everyone.
Okay.
But it's a training on SB 608.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And he's going to do it at the Ashland Library and at the Medford Library.
Two times.
And I thought that was really, really good. It's going to take place at Ashland Hills Hotel.
Oh, great.
We're going to be in our same room we were in last year, which is the, room downstairs.
Andromeda.
Thank you.
Whoa, good memory.
Looking at the materials that we printed up, and I saw that on there.
And so we'll be in the same room. And one thing that we did is Rich brought up Jeff Golden is our keynote speaker, and he's going to kind of lay down the not so much the law, but the ground rules and be respectful of each other and things like that. Our facilitator, we had kicked that idea out there, but I don't know.
Well, maybe Jeff. I mean, what you just described sounds a bit facilitator-esque.
Yes.
Well, we can see. So I volunteered to contact him, but I was out of town for the last 4 days, and I left a message, so we're in the message stage. I think the theme fits him quite well. which is the notion that we're moving forward with positive solutions, and that 608 represents that. And so I think the notion that we're bringing all these folks together to really move forward, and Jeff was up there when all this went on, and so I think he's like a really good thematic person. So we don't, I don't know if it's a keynote speech, that sounds a little heavy, but it's sort of a keynote theme that he can lay out with a little bit of the history of how the bill got passed, because that's a little bit of a good story too. So that was the kind of the direction.
Can you give the date again?
October 21st, Monday, October 21st.
Okay. And one of the things that we talked about with Jeff and potentially a facilitator who could or could not be Jeff was that we had toyed with, like, how do we have give this many panel speakers enough airtime to make it worth their while, but also have enough time for the audience to be able to ask questions and interact in a positive solution-focused way and not in a gripey way was our concern. And so we felt like having Jeff sort of set the tone with this legislation came out of compromise from, you know, people who have not necessarily dueling interests, but really we all have the same interests, but where can we work together and how can we move forward? And that what we saw is that we felt like we would probably need a facilitator to keep channeling people, because people, some people will talk more than others. Some people will sort of digress into stories that could be, you know, not as solution focused. And so how do we redirect?
So we can also have time limits and had timekeeper too.
Well, and that's where we thought a facilitator might be able to help sort of move people along and say, you know, I think we hear what you're saying, so is there a solution that you see out of this that you would like us to?
And so as we're getting that feedback, we're able to, we're going to have writing it up there, so we're capturing where people are at, but you're right, we have to, and the facilitation has to be able to politely cut people off if they're ongoing.
And Jeff would be that person who could.
I don't think so.
And keep them focused on the theme. You know, just to keep focused on the theme, because I think a lot of times people get in that venue,
yes,
and it's like, well, Jeff is here, and I can talk to Jeff, and here's this landlord-tenant lawyer, and I have this.
And get so mad about
this. And then this issue that happened to me, and like, what are you going to do about it? And it's like, well, I don't know. What
and that puts Jeff on the spot, and I'm not so sure he will want to be put on the spot.
Well, and I don't think any of the panelists do. I think the panelists are there to be helpful and supportive and solution focused. Like, out of these situations, what is the way that we can create positive change? That's
and that goes, if you look at our tentative agenda, I know we wanted to talk about that. How does that, reading that, how does that feel? And how does that flow? And just to touch what Linda talked about, just the theme, rent burden, rent stabilization, moving forward. We have solution in there, but we're not going to walk out and have a solution. So we pull that word and said moving forward, because that's what we want to do and keep it on a positive flow. Mm-hmm. And also we wanted to be able to give everyone something that they could take home with links and websites and information that they could go to, like Linda said, or someone, well, this happened to me and I'm going to hijack the meeting and I'm going to talk to Heidi because I'm going to tell her all about it or something. You know, so they can please take this with you, and if it applies, go to that link, make that phone call.
Great.
So what do you guys think about the flow?
It looks great to me. Dang.
And I like the timekeeper.
Looks wonderful.
So what we need is a facilitator. Do we have anybody who wants to volunteer in that role? Because I think a council person could do it.
Is the person on Jefferson Bailey that conducts the interview?
Jeff Riley? An outside person. Ooh, that would be interesting. Maybe Jefferson Public Radio would like to be there and to broadcast it.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. You want me to ask Jeff?
Yeah, sure.
Do you know him well?
Well, he's... well, kind of, sort of. I've been there a couple of times for MLK and for Pride.
That's awesome. So, okay. One, two.
Why don't we give it back to the subcommittee?
Okay.
And then we hear the Jeff Riley, and particularly whether there's an opportunity for coverage for that would be interesting.
So I have a friend who works at JPR, and I had lunch with another friend who makes videos, or does, like, I don't know what she does. Anyway, videos, production. And she kept saying, isn't there a place for Jefferson Public Radio to have production pieces, like when they have out-of-town musical guests who play in their stage, but you never see them, right? Or you see a picture of them on Facebook or whatever. So they actually hired her to make these little production videos of the musicians. But the funny thing was, out of that discussion, my friend who works for JPR, who doesn't do any of the production stuff, was saying she doesn't understand why JPR doesn't cover more local stuff, like really local stuff. Like, what, they're never present and interviewing people when things are happening in town, you know?
And where's the last council meeting?
Were they? You're kidding, because they never have been.
There was a reporter from JPR there.
That's amazing.
Yes, there was.
It was on the ordinance. It was when the ordinance.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, they heard you.
Yeah.
Well, I told her that, too. I was like, you know what? I don't listen to JPR for stuff like that, right? Like, I watch the local news because I'm not going to hear it on JPR, which is weird because you think they could.
Well, they might be interested in this because there will be a lot of concern and
we could do lead-up interviews, Gina, with on the Jefferson Exchange.
Wow. Oh,
Gina.
You, Gina.
Okay, so I think I hear enthusiasm for the plan as it's laid out.
It looks great.
We've got a aspiration about how we can pull JPR in there, and the committee will continue to do that. And the other thing that I wanted to note was that we really had a real aspirational ideas about how we do outreach. So we're going to be very aggressive about social media and other forms of outreach for this.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, that would help.
So anyway, so anybody want more feedback into us, let us know. But that's kind of the direction that we're going to be on. We can revisit it in September, too.
So. Yay.
Wonderful.
Okay. So now we are on liaison reports.
So the only things that we have going on, I mean, actually there's probably a lot of things that are going on, but right now the Jackson County Continuum of Care put out their request for proposals and received several responses, which was great. And I have been on the scoring committee for that process, which is always really challenging, I have to say. And what I will say is that, so who did we receive proposals from? We got a proposal. So right now, the program funds four main things. It funds Home at Last through Rogue Valley Council of Governments, which is essentially permanent supportive housing for people with disabilities. It supports four beds at Woodrow Pines, which is run by Access and is specifically for people with chronic mental health issues. And then it supports the transitional living program through Community Works, which is for teens, I think 18 to 25, and it's considered transitional housing, and it's essentially a leasing model. So they Community Works leases units and then puts these people in their program in units, and they also have case management that goes along with that. It's a whole
program. Individual units that are scattered around?
Yes.
Okay.
And the lease is held by Community Works.
Okay.
And they put people in the units. Thank you. That's a specific model that's allowed by HUD. And interestingly enough, HUD does not like transitional housing at all. They think it is not an effective program. They only like permanent supportive housing or rapid rehousing, which is also still considered permanent supportive housing. The only population that is allowed that they will still fund for transitional housing is homeless teens.
Teens.
Mm-hmm. And so the transitional living program is only for youth, what are called homeless youth, even though they go up to 25, I think, and then you can't be a part of the program anymore. But it's essentially supposed to, like, get you from one situation into, like, a more permanent situation. And then last year, am I missing one?
see, TLP, Wonderful Pines, Hal. Last year we got a bonus grant for, it was a DB bonus project, domestic violence bonus project for permanent supportive housing between Community Works, as a partnership between Community Works and Housing Authority, placing women who've been in domestic violence situations into permanent supportive housing in units that already exist at the Housing Authority. And it's still a scattered site, I think, leasing model. And so last year what was said in the NOFA, which is insanely complex and ridiculous, is that there was this $50,000 bonus project. And if you were awarded this bonus project, it would bring everything else up. The $50,000 would be taken off the top, and you would get all the other things that you ranked below. It would all move up. And this is the weird, complicated system. See, we have, there's a certain amount of money that we get. It's called our annual renewal amount. So it's how much money we get. And then we can get a bonus that's a percentage of that annual renewal amount. And then they'll have another bonus, not always, but this time they've had the DB bonus twice. And then we have to, within the amount of money that we have, that we already get, we have to rank them into Tier 1 and Tier 2. And Tier 1 is, we want all these things to be funded. Tier 2 is, maybe these things will get funded if we get the bonus money. So it's this whole strategy thing about how do we get the bonus money, because when you get the bonus money, then your annual renewal amount is bigger for the next year, so you can get more stuff, right? But there's a strategy to it, because HUD has all these rules about what they want and what they don't want. Like, they don't want transitional housing. They don't want, you know, they don't want you to keep funding the same people over and over and over, which we've done for years, and it's how we lost money before. And they want whatever it is that they want. So, like, this year, they had five things that they wanted. So it was, like, coordinated entry, and then there was rapid rehousing, there was the DV grant, there was some sort of planning around HMIS.
DV grant.
Domestic violence.
Oh, thank you.
So last year what happened was we got the $50,000 bonus, and we had pushed one of our projects down to where it straddled the line between Tier 1 and Tier 2. So half the funding was in Tier 1 and the other half of the funding was in Tier 2. And so what we risked was if they only fund our Tier 1s, then this program loses half of its funding. But if we get that DB grant, it's going to lift everything up. It goes off the top. We don't have to count it in the money that we had, right, because it's just extra now. It's extra money. Mm-hmm. And then that program will be fully funded. Mm. Well, we got the DB grant, but they only funded the other program half. We actually got two notices of award. One showed them being fully funded, and the other showed them being halfway funded. And they only got half the money. And had said, yeah, that one was a mistake. So we appealed it 6 months ago, and we haven't heard yet. So they did it again this year. They said, if you get your $50,000 bonus, we'll lift everything up. So we had to do it again. We straddled something.
What is the reason that they give for wanting the diversification, like, over the years? Because especially it seems like in smaller communities, you would want, like, well-grounded, established, you know, like, organizations that are able to follow through on what they're doing.
Tried and true.
You know, they've been around. Anyways, so do they give a reason for that, or?
No.
Okay.
They would.
Good question.
It is a good question. Part of it is that they don't want any one organization to rely on that as a consistent source of funding.
I think that's in foundations. Right. You want a little bit.
Here's your starter
you
money
to start seeing somebody
look for other sources of funding
stable
to
funding on
I mean,
their
there
own.
Is a match requirement, but it's not huge. But the other thing that they have, which is the part that doesn't make sense, is that they have, so there's all this reporting, which when you're in the HMIS system, it has all this information, and it kicks out these reports that are called APRs. And they're super complicated to read and then to line up with HUD's reading tool. Anyway, so
guys, it's complicated for you. I mean, my brain would be mush. I can't imagine
you
doing this.
So HUD says what they really would like you to do is to reallocate the money from these lower performing renewal projects to new projects, which is funny because it's like, who knows if they'll be lower performing.
Exactly.
And it's based on the APR, and they give you points. They're like, let's look at how long did people stay in this program? How many people transitioned
to permanent supportive housing, or left this program into permanent supportive housing as opposed to the street or a shelter? And how many people had income at the beginning and or didn't have income at the beginning but had income at the end? And how much of that was income from employment versus income from, like, getting Social Security? So all those things are on the APR, and they all have points. And so you use those points on in HUD's system, which we use because HUD's really rating this, even though they're like local governments rate it. But the ultimate thing is, and it's, we all feel bad about this process at the end, but here's the thing. We just want more money for our community. And we will do whatever it takes in the HUD NOFA to get more money. Because ultimately, it's all serving the same people. And so that's the crummy part about it, is that when you make these decisions, you're making the decision based on what HUD says they want. So, like, okay, we'll reallocate that money if that's what you want us to do. You get 20 points? So we were 20 points away from the threshold last time. And we get, I think it's 4 or 5 points for reallocating money. And we didn't reallocate any money last time. So it's like we're chipping away at our 20 points so that we can get some of our Tier 2 projects funded. Even if that means taking money from an established organization and giving it to a new project.
It's a level of bureaucracy that's just beaten my mind down.
Exactly.
Oh, it's
a good way to put it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, okay. So are we done?
If we fund the same organization again, but they have a new project?
Yes.
That works.
That works.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so there is a whole there's categories are renewal plus expansion, and new projects, and then bonus projects.
So maybe we want to say that.
And we did have a renewal plus expansion.
Okay.
And they all get rated differently. They all have different rating criteria. Anyway, so that's, I don't know when we'll find out, but we are submitting the application in like a week.
Takes a while, though, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, we have to submit it as a coordinated application. So all the applications go in together with our COC application.
So, for instance, if something like Aura were funding the shelter and 20 people moved out of the shelter into housing of one sort or another, that would qualify as a new project?
They probably have to call it something new. And
well, for example, Home at Last used to receive like $100,000, more than that. Because they were the one that was straddling Tier 1 and Tier 2, their allocation dropped down to like $50,000. So they had to move people off of it because they were doing a permanent supportive housing voucher program. So they had to move those people out. They had to leave, right, because they couldn't pay their rent anymore. Because they only got half their money. Well, it is permanent supportive housing as long as you have the money to pay for the housing.
Yeah.
So they lost half their funding through this process. So they had to move those people out. So their project that they submitted a renewal for the existing funding they have, and then they submitted an expansion to expand the program that they are already doing to increase their capacity to serve more people. So that was their renewal plus expansion.
And that was not.
Well.
Oh, we don't.
So, and the terrible thing is, so we rate them and rank them, because that's what HUD wants, and then we have to put them all together with the continuum of care stuff, because there's a bunch of administrative pieces that HUD asks, like, how is your continuum of care functioning? Who's on your board? How often do they meet? Blah, blah, blah. So that's the part that Connie Wilkerson, thank the Lord, is here to do, because she's coordinating all that. Yeah. So they'll put it all together, send it up to HUD, then HUD reviews it on their own, and they don't actually tell us what tool or what they're looking at or anything, and then they just say, okay, here's your award.
This magic.
It's total magic, which is why we have to use their tool, because I'm like, this is the only clue we have to how they're judging our projects. Whatever we choose doesn't matter. It's what they choose. That's what matters.
And it almost sounds like,
and I don't know what that is.
You just can redo things. Like your example, Heidi, you know, you just take that and change it all around and call it an expansion and a renewal, and as long as you use the same language and just sort of switch the cups around, it'll work.
Well, we'll see how this works with the expansion, because they didn't like that it was a renewal. They were like, you have been funding this project over and over again for like 10 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And it was it's a high performing project.
Does it vary depending on who the president is and who his appointee is, the head.
Probably not.
Honestly, it is like a mystery to me what happens after that.
I don't think it's changed that much.
It is just a mystery. And so we have, my HUD rep is the COC HUD rep too, and she is not allowed to answer essentially any questions because it might give us a competitive edge over any other COC. Even questions like, well, here it says and then here it says or. So does
That's
it mean
right.
a bonus?
That's not right.
Or does it mean a bonus and reallocate? Because at one point it said the bonus can be funded with reallocated money and bonus money, or a project can be funded with reallocated money and bonus money. And then down in the other section about the reallocation, it said a reallocation can be, or a bonus, a new project can be funded with bonus or reallocation. So it was like, well, is it and or is it or? Because we could have split one between,
right.
we'll reallocate $20,000 from this program and add it to $60,000 of bonus to fully fund it. Mm-hmm. But are you saying we can't do that or can we do that? Can it only be reallocation or can it only be bonus or can it be a combination of both?
Sorry, that's a secret.
Right. I can tell you the answer to that. It might make it.
Okay. Okay, so we liaison.
We feel your pain.
So I just wanted to read Dennis's liaison report, which he sent. He said, I will not be making today's meeting. My liaison report could contain two major items. First, I continue to meet with the sheriff regarding clarifying the county's plans for the new jail as it applies to mental health and addiction services and how they link to services beyond the jail. I think these are going well and have been informative. We continue to suggest further clarification. I think the sheriff has done a responsible job of educating the group. Second, that was all one point, our cost review ad hoc group for the city will get started in September. First up will be ambulance services, but eventually we will look at all the funds under the general fund. So I recommend people stay tuned as things come forward. So that was his report. So they're going to look at the funding mechanisms for the city, and the sheriff's piece is out there.
And when do they look at social service grants?
Didn't say that was in there.
Before he said you'll want to pay attention to that.
Right. He said all it says in here is that the first thing up is ambulances. Mm-hmm. So I know there's a controversy about that. And
what's their meeting schedule?
What?
How will we know when?
It'll be on the city website. They announce all the meetings.
So the my spouse goes to the sheriff's meetings, and so I kind of gotten filled in on what that is, and I think
can you tell us more than?
Well, I think it's very presentation heavy, so they've made presentations a lot on addiction. The first meeting was on what we do for addictions, and the second one was how a whole system for mental health and how that would operate within a jail framework. And so there's, as Dennis says, there's been little discussion about money and where this is and what the actual, you know, going out for a levy will be. So that's the part that they haven't got to yet. So if you were there, you'd learn a lot about what's happening on the mental health system.
I saw the overheads. We were given
right.
the overheads, yeah.
Right. Well, that's it. I mean, so that's kind of where they're at. And so I think the essence is that the sheriff is hoping, and that if we all understand all this, we're just going to kind of go right back out. And I think I heard tangentially that they were thinking of May. Hmm. But that's the part where it gets really murky at this point. And so I would bring it up also from the standpoint of, I think that as we're moving forward on homeless and housing and these issues, that the issue of mental health in Ashland needs to be
absolutely.
Needs to be addressed. And I don't, I'm not putting it on today, but as we look at this going forward, I think that is a really, the CCOs are in turmoil, good or bad. And
what does that mean when you say continuum of care options are in turmoil?
No, the CCO,
all care in
Jackson. So, as you all know or may know, that all care, Jackson Care Connect just got their overall sponsor is Care Oregon, just got assimilated into Providence. And okay. So, between what Providence does for insurance and what All Care does, or Jackson Care Connect does for insurance, they have a quarter of all the population of Oregon. So it's so there's a consolidation going on, and then thrown into that somehow, as you all have heard, the Jackson County Commission has wants to decommission All Care. How they can do that? Because I've been on both committees, and when they got formed 5 years ago, the county commission had to approve that, each one of them. But since then, it seems like the state has made the decisions on who is going
to
be a CCO and not the county commission.
Yeah.
But if you look at those,
you would have more control.
If you look at those two things together, the Jackson Care Connect going into Providence and this kind of huge consolidation, it's not just, they're not the only ones. Maybe that somehow is relation to what they're doing.
And is that how the 700 jobs have been lost at Providence as well?
What?
I just heard somebody's losing their job and they said they're laying off 700 employees and transferring them to India. So Maggie Eklund, I don't know if you know her.
Right, I do.
She's moving to Portland now because she's lost her job at Providence.
Wow.
Right, I think that's...
Is it connected?
I think it's only connected in that healthcare is becoming consolidated. The CCOs were first, and it seemed like continuing to be decentralizing into communities, and we were reaping the benefit of that decentralization. We may see more of a consolidation as people kind of lump together, and how that's going to affect all care, I'm not sure. It wouldn't put them out of business because they have two other counties.
Yeah.
But the question about
are they trying to... Well, the funds that are allocated to Jackson County that they've already committed, like, how does that work? I mean, I'd be curious.
Well, I think the place that... This is what I wanted to say. Is the place that I think that it hits us is mental health in Ashland, and to a certain extent, the county, because it seems like there's an enormous amount of... What would you say? Uncoordination at this point.
It's like a black hole.
And we would do better with a better coordinated program. I don't think the sheriff's going to deal with that, but I think we ought to be down the future looking at how we kind of get ourselves educated about those issues. So are there other updates before we go?
So if I need to educate myself more about what you're talking about, where should I go? Like, should I Google All Care?
Well, I mean,
what if we had somebody to come and talk to us?
That'd be great. I would really appreciate that.
The healthcare caucus of the Jackson County Democratic Party, just like a month ago or so, it wasn't long ago, had a mental health forum and got together a bunch of speakers and stuff, so there might be some resources.
The healthcare caucus of the Democratic Party?
Yeah, Lori Hovland is a still practicing full-time nurse, and she works with La Clinica and does the mobile unit, so she's also really tied into, what the needs of the community are, because she sees it, on the front.
I wonder if she would
line.
Be willing to talk with us.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, because I really like to hear.
About finding a slot in her schedule.
How does what's going on affect Ashland and the Rogue Valley We absolutely need more mental health services. We mm-hmm. need to figure out how to do this, but I don't understand how all the pieces are working right now.
I'm not sure how many people really do. Mm-hmm.
Do they lock mental care in with addiction, or is that a separate thing?
No.
Well, because
that's we'd like it to be more together, I think.
So just remember that the coordinated care is all one thing, and we are making progress. There's many of the both addiction services and mental health services are being embedded in medical care centers, mm-hmm. and so the idea is to sort of knock down the walls around that.
Yeah, but I think the challenge for that, or I mean, at least what I've heard, is that. So, for example, doctors cannot, just regular general practice doctors, if someone comes to them, and which happens, and says, like, I have I'm addicted to heroin and I want to quit, can you give me medical assisted treatment? And they can't, because you can only do it if you're qualified to do medical assisted treatment, and you can only start it if you've had an assessment and if you've done these steps. And general practice doctors aren't certified to do those things, and so they usually have a partner agency that they could refer out to. Mm-hmm. So like La Clinica refers out to the ARC, so it's like, well, let me call the ARC and see if I can get you an appointment to get this assessment, and then you'll work with them, and then you can come back here, and then we'll figure out how to get you this. So La Clinica does now have a treatment or a center that integrates both of those things, right. But they are still trying to get people processed to get the trainings to administer the assessment.
The problem with that is it takes too long, and by then they're...
Well, no, yeah, that's what happens. Exactly. So then the next week they're like,
when they
okay,
come to you and say,
right,
I want to do it right now, you have to be able right to get them in right there. Yeah.
So that's a big barrier that they've been trying to overcome. But and I think the hard part is, like, we all understand, like, yeah, it should just all be seamless and coordinated. Mm-hmm. But in the medical industry, it's as much bureaucracy as really anywhere else. Mm-hmm.
You know, historically, when I came to the Rogue Valley in 95, all the mental health funds came to Jackson County and private providers that had contracts with the state. And then they developed a MHOs. They had one with Dave Pump was, I don't know if you remember him, was the director, and he had a part-time secretary. That grew to at least 60 employees of an MHO, and now we've got, with nobody providing direct services, but all having fat salaries, and now it's the CCOs, and all this money is spent on administrative people.
And it's getting just, to the people.
I've been waiting for the CCOs to be replaced by something else, and it sounds like the CCOs will get bigger and consolidate and get further from the patient, client, and more administrative salaries and more layers of management, and it's just going that direction.
And, you know,
so it's a dismal process. And
it's almost like
the PR is we're merging mental health, physical health, and dental health. There are no barriers and whatever, but doesn't seem to be panning out.
Sounds horrible.
Well, I've been on two of those CCOs. We got other people here that are on the CCO advisory committees. I mean, we're not going to continue it now, but there's a very positive discussion about what has been able to have happen. I got children who are, you know, members of one of those, and you can kind of see it. And there is a lot more that needs to happen. Mm-hmm. Just as a weird thing, if you remember it, is I just saw this thing today that Kitzhaber, who in some ways is sort of the father of healthcare in Oregon, and absolutely, and he is going to D.C. to talk about it, this is all about Medicaid and all that, and you put this is the political part, is that there's some people anticipating that we're going to have major change in the way that we deal with health care in the next few years, And so,
in a good way, right?
Healthcare
for the better.
The Medicare for All is not as much of a dream as it was. And so Kitzhaber is going there, and his message is not about funding. His message is about delivery. And it's about all the things that we are doing in Oregon. And he's going to deliver a positive message about how the CCOs have worked and what the principles are about that. So I think that is kind of out there for the future.
Okay, good. That sounds positive. Yes. I'm happy
it
to
is.
Hear that.
It is. It's a positive, but I think there is the other part is that, you know, you do have another bureaucracy. How do you keep that bureaucracy from growing on top of it and put the dollars down into the places where it's needed?
And is it?
Okay, I think it's 10 minutes early, and we can adjourn, and I thank you all
for lively
discussions on this.
Oh, yes.
How's the wrong date?
Yeah.
So,
it's the
26th.
Yes,
I'm like the 22nd.
Oh, yes. Hold over for a moment.